You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station. The BFM Breakfast Grill. Top interviews you can't afford to miss. Presented by the CIMB Group.
Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris, and today joining us on The Breakfast Grill is Professor Glyn Davis, Vice Chancellor of the University of Melbourne in Australia. Thanks so much for joining us today, Professor. Welcome to the show.
It's a great pleasure, Melissa. It's lovely to be here.
Let's start on a bigger picture first. I'm looking at the international education as a whole for the Australian economy. It's actually the largest services export earner for Australia. That's second only to that of extractive commodities like coal and iron ore. How do you view the position of Australia in the global higher education industry?
Thanks, Melissa, and that's exactly right. It takes a little while for us to get used to the idea that after coal and iron ore, education is the single largest export industry in the country, much bigger, for example, than tourism, which for a long time has been our leading service industry. But it's part of a global trend, a trend that Malaysia is very much part of as well. This year, it's estimated there's about 3.7 million students around the world who've left their home and are studying somewhere abroad. That's an enormous number of people. And they're going right around the globe. Many of them are coming to Australia. Many of them, of course, coming to Malaysia. And they come from every country. It's not that they're all coming from China. It's just many students are now going to China to study. The traffic between Malaysia and Australia runs both ways. Many Australian students come to Malaysia for a study abroad experience or longer, just as many Malaysian students come to Australia to study. So, and that's what we're seeing around the planet now. Students travelling in every direction, and lots of countries are both net exporters of students, or they're exporters of students, and they're also importers, as it were. So it's a very interesting development. Australia's been a global leader in this, one of the most successful countries in the world in international education, but so has Malaysia, so has Singapore. It's a phenomenon of our region. It started first in our region and it's now spread across the planet. And I think it's going to be a very important part of the future for Malaysia and for Australia.
So do you see Australia positioned to be an education hub for the Asian region? Because geographically, you're quite far away from the European countries and the US.
Absolutely. There won't be one hub. There'll be many hubs. There's no doubt, looking at the number of international students studying in Kuala Lumpur, for example, that KL is a hub. Singapore is clearly a hub. And the large Australian cities, Brisbane and Sydney, as well as Melbourne, have all operated in very similar ways. And I think that will be the pattern of the future. Many Asian students will choose an Australian experience as part of their education, and many Australian students likewise will choose to come to Asia. So there won't be one centre. It'll be an international network of linked cities where students flow back and forth between each other.
Well, if there are going to be many hubs, then what will make Australia different as an education centre?
I guess the Australian offer is based on, first, the quality of the institutions. And the Times, for example, ranks the University of Melbourne as in the top 30 in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very important for students. They want some external indication of quality of experience. The second is many students would like to spend time in predominantly an English-speaking environment in order to improve and test their own language skills, and so it helps for Australia that we're an English-speaking nation. And the third is quality of life, quality of facilities, quality of the cities where people get to live. It exposes people to a different way of seeing the world and a different group of people. One of the really enjoyable things about the University of Melbourne and other Australian universities when, say, we come to Kuala Lumpur and we meet with our alumni, and we have nearly 7,000 Malaysian alumni across your country, is many of them have retained their links. They've got good friends in Australia. They occasionally come back. They see Australia as an important part of their journey. And for us, that's very exciting, because that's how you build really deep cooperation and collaboration between nations.
Well, as you mentioned, other countries like China and Hong Kong, even Singapore, South Korea, they're all really building their higher education domestically. They've got very high quality universities. And in that case, maybe some of the students might not even be looking to study abroad. Has that impacted business?
You're absolutely right. And the quality of institutions across the region is rising, and rising very quickly. And yes, it must affect some students who would once have studied abroad, who will now stay home and do at least a first degree at home. But our experience has been pretty continuous growth over the last 20 years. So even where there's very good provision at home, there are still many students who, for personal or other reasons, want the international experience and look not locally but internationally as for their education. Increasing trend too to graduate education. So people will often do a first degree at home and then look to do a second, say a master's degree in another country. And Australian students are like that. Many Australians are going abroad now for their second degree.
What about policy factors or economic factors within Australia? Has visa restrictions actually hurt student enrollment? What about the fact that, I think over the last couple of years, the Aussie dollar was very high against other currencies in the region?
Yes, there are some serious downsides to having a mining boom, and one of them is that they push the exchange rates. We hadn't seen exchange rates that high ever, and it certainly affected international demand for places in Australia. Australia had been a relatively comparable place with, say, Malaysia to study and to live, and the exchange rate pushed that a great differential. It's slowly coming down again as the mining boom slowly becomes part of the norm and settles a little, and I'm hoping to see the Australian dollar fall to make Australia more affordable and more accessible to more people. The visa policy is also very important, and Australia made some policy changes around 2009-2010, which in retrospect turned out to be not a good choice, and they made it harder for international students to come to Australia, and they without doubt depressed the numbers who chose Australia. If it's easier to get in other places, if you want to study abroad, you choose the place that's welcoming, that's affordable, and it has a visa policy that encourages you and makes it easy. We didn't meet that test. There's been a lot of policy change since then, big changes to the visa system. We seem to be back on track.
But specifically for University of Melbourne, did you see a big hit in student enrollment? Do you have figures to share with us?
We didn't. Most Australian universities had a fall in enrolments from 2010 of 20% or so. Our numbers actually grew. I think that's to do with the reputation of the institution and the very high international rankings. So we felt no effect, but we watched other institutions clearly affected. So it hurt most Australian universities. We were just very fortunate not to be amongst those.
Well, for some universities, international students make up over half of their enrolment. What is it like for University of Melbourne? What's the breakdown for your student population?
Our student population is about one-third international students. So we have about 12,000 international students on our Parkville campus here in Melbourne. And that's about average for Australian universities, or a little higher, but not much higher. What's unusual about the University of Melbourne is that we have one large campus. Many Australian universities have multiple campuses. We're located in one campus, which means all 12,000 of those students interacting with almost all of our Australian students, many of them sharing accommodation in colleges and student accommodation around the campus. So it produces a very lively community of international students and local students in a very lively district of the city, very close to the city centre, which means the students also have access to all the facilities of the city. And that makes for a really dynamic place, a very enjoyable place to be part of. And for our Malaysian and other international students, there are enough other international students so you can both talk to people from home who you're comfortable and familiar with and whose company you enjoy, as well as meeting students from other countries and from Australia. I guess our objective is that as people go home at the end of their degree, that they'll take with them friendships, not just with Australians, but with other international students from other places they met while they studied here.
Well, where are the other students from in terms of countries?
Malaysia is one of our single largest source countries. China is slightly larger again. We have a significant number from China, slightly smaller numbers from Singapore, a growing cohort from Indonesia, a significant and growing cohort from South America, particularly Chile, and Brazil, which are beginning to send students to us in some numbers, smaller numbers from India, and some numbers, small in number, but growing quite quickly from North America, from America and Canada. So it's a very lively mix of students. It has a bias towards students from Southeast Asia, but by no means that's the whole cohort.
Today on The Breakfast Grill, I'm speaking to Professor Glyn Davis, Vice-Chancellor of the University of Melbourne in Australia. After this, we'll talk about the higher education landscape in Australia post-elections.
BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris, and today joining us on The Breakfast Grill is Professor Glyn Davis, Vice Chancellor of the University of Melbourne in Australia. Professor, let's talk a little bit about the faculty of the university. Now, what challenges would you say in a world of constrained resources, how do you ensure that you've got the right staff, the best quality staff?
It's a great question, Melissa, and thank you. We have about 9,000 staff at the University of Melbourne, of whom slightly under half are academic staff. It's a very senior university with a strong research record, so it has very high standards in recruitment and in tenure. So we have, for example, the Nobel laureate Peter Doherty working here, teaching in immunology, and a range of people holding very senior roles. One of our professors in the medical faculty won the Lasker Prize just a week ago, which is a major prize in the discipline. So that's encouraging. Many of our staff are members of the Royal Society, and many of them have international experience. That's really important. You want to produce on the staffing side, a bit like the students we were just talking about, people who have a range of experiences, who bring lots of international contacts, and who create the sense that a university is a little global city in a larger city. That when you go to a university, you meet people from around the world there on staff as students, and you're part of a conversation that isn't confined by local concerns and local culture, but is actually much broader than that. And in an interesting way, that's a return to the historic notion of what a university was meant to be, a place where people came together from all over the place rather than just locals. And that's very welcome from our point of view. So choosing the right staff, making them part of the campus, making sure that students have access to the really great staff, all of those are part of the mix of a great university.
That's true. Well, as the head of the university, I'm sure you'd have to balance your resources, your funding, with the need to find the best staff, retaining the best staff, and giving them enough time to do research. How do you balance the two? Because tertiary education, higher education in Australia has undergone a series of funding cuts from the federal government.
Sad but true, Melissa. We had seen some cuts to federal funding in recent times. That said, by international standards, we're sitting in about the average of the OECD world for university funding. Australian universities do very well with relatively modest funding on research and other measures internationally. And as I say, the fact that this institution is ranked in the top 30 in the world by the Times suggests that we've sort of found a way balance on that. It is hard to find enough resources to do everything you want to do. You rely on your academic staff to be able to win grants, and many of them are successful. The University of Melbourne is the most successful in the country at winning research grants, and that brings in sufficient, but not always, additional money to be able to do all of the research that we want to do as part of the broader research ambition. We have a series of what we call grand challenges, things that we want to make a difference in, about understanding our place in the world, about sustainability, about using technology for a better world, and we cluster our researchers around those topics, and we use them as good ways of deciding who to hire and what it is they're going to work on when they're with us.
In terms of ratio breakdown, how much of university funding comes from student tuition as opposed to federal funding?
It's a great question. Around 22% of our funding comes directly from the Australian government and is untied, is to support the infrastructure. Around a third of our income comes from student tuition, perhaps rising toward a half. Between a third and a half comes from, and the rest is research money won through grants.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's money from our endowment. We're fortunate to have built up over the 160 years that the university has been running a relatively significant endowment, and each year that provides some money that we can use to support great research and often to support student scholarships, which is a very important part of making the universities accessible to as many people as we can. So we provide quite a few scholarships, both for international students and for Australian students, and that's about ensuring that people who might otherwise have struggled financially to get here have a chance to study at the University of Melbourne.
That's curious, that 22% that you see from federal government, how much was it, say, when you first became Vice-Chancellor back in 2005? Has there been a big difference?
It hasn't changed a great deal in the last decade, but it has changed enormously in the last generation. So when I was a student, around 90% of funding for universities came from the federal government, and it was free for Australian students to go to university. And in one generation, we've gone from that, from it being relatively expensive for Australian students to go to university and for Australian universities to have to rely on sources of income other than government in order to operate. And that is a very radical change. It didn't happen all at once. It happened year after year, and we've sort of got used to it. And by around 2005, which is when I joined the University of Melbourne, we'd reached that stage of about 22%, and it's remained thereabouts. Now, the government would argue that it's a higher figure because it would include the value of the student fees, but our argument is it's the students who pay that, not the government, and so that's how we work it out. But the government will always say, oh, no, really, the figure's closer to half. But it is if you include student fees, but it's the students who are paying it.
Well, with the recent elections and the change in government, are you expecting to see more funding from the federal government?
We have just had a federal election, as you note, on the 7th of September, and we've seen a change of government. Changes of government happen in Australia every other decade. They're not very common. They're more common than they used to be, but so it's a big thing that happens when a government changes. In this case, we've moved from a Labor government, centrist left government, to a conservative government, which I guess is a centrist right government, and both of them have very similar policies in many areas, including around universities. I'm not sadly anticipating a sudden increase in government funding for universities, but I'm hoping nor will we see further cuts. So if we can see a steady state policy for a few years, that would be a good operation. There's not a huge difference in view between the major political parties about the university systems, and universities are rarely part of the debate during an election campaign.
Oh, was it really part of the electoral consciousness? Because I didn't notice that much of it didn't really crop up that much. So I'm wondering whether now that there's been a change, well, do you think you'll see a huge difference in the higher education landscape?
You're entirely right, I think, in how you've characterised that. It didn't pop up at all. It just wasn't a topic for discussion during the election campaign. Neither party, neither the then governing Labor Party nor the opposition coalition put out a major policy statement on education. They made some small announcements, but no major one. And if you were voting on education alone, it would have been very hard to say what the difference between the two parties were. The arguments were about different sorts of issues, but not about education. I'm not anticipating, therefore, major changes in policy. It's a relatively steady-as-we-go policy environment, I suspect. But politics is a strange game, and we'll see how it works out over the next 3 years. And an Australian government only gets 3 years. It's a relatively short term. So we'll be back at the polls in 2016, and the world may be a very different place by then.
Well, if you had the power to make changes or to make improvements to the system, then what would be your priorities if you could have written a portfolio for that?
If I was king for the day.
Yes.
Wouldn't it be fun? Well, I would put more public money into universities. That's the first thing I do, but you'd expect me to say that. I would make it easier for international students to spend more time in Australia around their studies, because I think we benefit by having large numbers of international students here. I would encourage more PhD scholarships so that more students can come to do further research. I think that's going to be an important part of the world we're all moving into, and I would like to see more graduate students having a chance to do really detailed research projects on a whole range of areas. And I would like to see many more joint appointments between Malaysian universities and Australian universities. I think we benefit when staff have a foot in each country and are able to contribute to both. And it's sort of hard to do that at the moment. It's hard funding it. It's hard doing the logistics. It's difficult for families to move back and forth. But I think if we could find ways to make it easier for people to spend time in both countries, we would strengthen the ties, and that would be well worth doing.
That's an interesting point that you've brought up, and it brings me to my next question about partnerships, because in this age of globalization, it's all about making international partnership agreements for most universities. Where does the University of Melbourne stand on this? What partnerships have you formed?
We have partnerships with around 300 universities around the globe, so it's an important part of this and every other institution's nature. University presidents make jokes about every day they're signing a new memorandum of understanding with yet another university. Most of those are purely technical. They're about ensuring that if your students go to study at Malaysia University, that they'll be properly looked after and that their study will be accredited for the purposes of graduation. And likewise, we sign those agreements so that when Malaysian students come to us, they get looked after, they get access to the campus and the library and all the things that should go with that. So many of those are collaboration, but in a relatively modest way. They allow students to flow back and forth. We then have a handful of very detailed agreements around the countries. So Universitas de Malaya, for example, is an institution we've had a long-term relationship with, and we're both members of an organisation called the Association of Pacific Rim Universities, and that's been an important and enduring link. We have UITM as another partner. We have institute links with the forestry research group in Malaysia. So there are a lot of individual research links, but we've not been a university that's created overseas campuses, and there are a number of international universities that have campuses in Malaysia. I visited a couple of them recently to see what they're doing. And you also have in Malaysia a very interesting and growing private sector, Taylor's College and other significant players. And we've been watching them with great interest, and we have links with a number of them, and that's not something we see so often in Australia, but it's been very interesting to watch their success and their growing role in Malaysia.
So do you think you would set up a physical campus here in Malaysia?
It's not something we've contemplated, not because we don't think there are great things to do, but because there are good institutions already operating in Malaysia, and in the past at least, we've tended to see a flow of students, Malaysian students, who've wanted to come to Melbourne rather than wanting to study at a Melbourne campus in Malaysia. So that, for example, we've for 60 years been welcoming students in architecture from Malaysia, and we have a number of very distinguished now senior architects who are graduates, and they have tended to encourage their younger staff to come to Melbourne and study with us rather than ask us to come to teach in Malaysia. And I think it's that thing we were talking about earlier, it's the broader experience, it's not just what you learn in the classroom, it's who you meet, it's operating for some in a different language or at least improving their English skills, and it's about being part of a different community, a different society, and being able to see your own society more clearly when you come home. And that's a really important reason for studying abroad, and we'll probably go on encouraging a significant flow of Malaysian students to think about Melbourne as a study destination rather than contemplate opening a campus in Malaysia.
This morning I've been speaking to Professor Glyn Davis, the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Melbourne. Professor, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you today. Thank you for being on the show this morning.
Melissa, thank you very much. Thank you for such astute questions.
I'm Melissa Idris for BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by the CIMB Group, Southeast Asia's leading universal bank. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.